I don't know when I first discovered that Detective Bobby Sabatini of the St. Paul Police Department had a photographic memory for poetry. He always tucked a couple of slim volumes of verse into the flap pockets of his silk jacket or curled them into the pouches of his bomber. I heard that the stuff came spewing out of him all day. He'd recite Ginsberg or Gary Snyder to some kid making espressos at Dunn Brothers, a bit of a blue-collar poem by Philip Levine to an ancient gal scanning groceries at Kowalski's. Everybody loved it because Sabatini did it with a light touch. A tall, slender man with silvered temples, Sabatini dressed better than any cop I've ever known. Dude was his own man, played viola in the university orchestra at Michigan State, just as I played cello at Berkeley. He was also a long-distance runner during college, claimed he kept himself going by humming bars from Bartok's third and fourth string quartets. I got to know Sabatini before his poetry conversion in the late 90s. We met at the murder scene of one of my clients. A week later, we played quartets together. I was still grieving for my client and craved some musical solace. I gathered a couple of fiddle players I knew, both pharmacists, and the four of us made a few righteous runs through Haydn's string quartet in D, The Lark. I fell in love with the Adagio Cantabile. The first violinist, the pharmacist with the longer nose, had a lovely tone. The second fiddle, Sabatini, and I strung out some sweet chords. Of course, Bobby and I had smoked down a nice nugget of hash before we started playing, and the pharmacists clearly had their own secrets. I'd never really thought of Sabatini as a priestly man, but shortly after 9/11, when he had his prostate problem, the poetry hit him like a calling. Another cop might have gone and drowned himself, but Sabatini embraced the poetry like a man with a mission. Despite the fact that this story begins with a troubled violinist and ends with gunfire and protest songs, I'll remember its soundtrack in verse. Sabatini was quite persuasive with the stuff and infected more than a few of us.
This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. That was a reading from The Man in the Blizzard, a new novel by Bart Schneider, and Bart is here with me in the studio. It's good to have you.
Great to be here, Rosemary.
Yeah. You recently moved back to Sonoma County from Minnesota.
Yeah, I'd actually grew up in San Francisco. I lived my first 31 years in San Francisco and then spent 25 years in Minnesota. So I've never lived in Sonoma County before, but I spent a lot of time here in the intervening years.
Well, it's easy to like.
That's not a problem, no. I grew up out in the fog by the ocean in San Francisco, and then with 25 good solid winters, I thought I needed a warm spot.
Yeah. What took you to Minnesota?
I was working, writing plays in those days, and I got a fellowship to work with a theater back there, and you know, it's one of those things, you go for 1 year and stay for 25,
yes,
raise a family.
And, and was it while you were out there that you were founding editor of the Hungry Mind Review?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how did that come about?
Well, I started working in what was then a very wonderful bookstore, Hungry Mind Bookstore, and this was in the days right before the chain bookstores became as dominant as they've become, way before online bookselling. But we could see the writing on the wall, so we wanted to create a book review magazine that became kind of a link between independent bookstores around the country. And, you know, at its height, we distributed in about 600 independents around the country. And I lasted there for 15 years. The magazine went on a little longer than I did.
Mm-hmm. We are great fans of independent bookstores here in Sonoma County and really supportive of them.
I'm happily associated with one in Sonoma Reader's Books. It's a great little bookstore, one of those stores you walk in that kind of feels like everything has been hand-chosen for you.
Oh, yes. It's outstanding. And
how do they know my mind? How do they know my curiosity so well?
And a lot of good readers in Sonoma Town, I'm sure.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to have you in Sonoma County.
Thank you.
Yeah. Your book, The Man in the Blizzard, is set in Minneapolis and St. Paul during the Republican National Convention. While you were writing the book, did you have some tip-off that the convention was going to take place in Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Well, you know, I had started it well before that had been determined and had no clue that such a thing was going to happen. But I was working, wanting to write a political book, and the backdrop I'd set was Labor Day, because there was going to be this huge anti-abortion rally in my novel that mobilized people from all over the country to come and take Labor Day back for women giving birth in medical tents around the Capitol grounds who would come willingly and be induced at full term. And so, you know, I was working on that, and lo and behold, they scheduled this convention to be right there, down the block, essentially, from the state capitol, starting on Labor Day. Mm-hmm. The part I didn't get was the Sarah Palin thing. You know?
Yes. You'd already gone to...
I'd gone to press about 6 months before the convention, yes. So I couldn't do anything about that.
Well, who could ever have predicted that? I've forgotten who got the vice presidency in your novel.
Tim Pawlenty, who was... Mm-hmm. Or the Tim Pawlenty character.
Yes, the Tim Pawlenty character, whom you called...
Jim Holcim.
Jim Holcim.
Without a W.
Wonderful.
and it looked like he was going right down to the wire. He was right in there with the top two or three people, and yeah. I was really rooting for that. And,
yeah.
But it's a tricky business writing ahead of the actual events.
Yes. And, but you created the tension that carries people right through the book to that incredible scene with the anti-abortion groups on Labor Day. Your other novels are in a little different direction. How did you decide to write a detective novel?
I don't know. This character just sort of came to me, and... Also, I wanted to write something in my three previous novels were all set in the Bay Area in the 60s mm-hmm. and
yes.
70s, and I wanted to write something in the present, and I'm dodging your question about the detective, but maybe I'll get back to that along the way. So I couldn't figure out where to set this, so I knew it was going to be a Labor Day. Was it going to be Labor Day 2006? I was writing it in 2005, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they came with the convention.
They came to your town. That was it. Well, it sounds like your character found you and wanted to be in the story.
Yeah, they always do.
They do that, right. And you create wonderful characters.
Oh, thank you very much.
I hadn't met you before today, but from reading your work, I felt that I knew some things about you, and I'm guessing that you like politics, poetry, and music.
Yeah, I think all three.
Let's talk about politics first. Setting the story in the midst of the Republican National Convention opens a lot of opportunities for your private eye, Augie Boyer.
It gives me the opportunity to let he and his buddy, the police detective Sabatini, you know, rant a little bit.
Yes.
And you know, it's a question of how much ranting can you get away with, and who's me and who's them, and also I should tell listeners that Augie Boyer, who's the main character here, has a daughter whose name is Minnesota Rose. That's her. She's a singer songwriter that's political, and so that gave me a chance to have another kind of voice articulate some left-wing politics. And, you know, the question as you're writing these things is, how do I parse this stuff out, you know, because you can't just do political rants. Right. So if you give enough people voices, it gets kind of interesting, mm-hmm. I think, you know. You think I got away with as much political ranting as I do in this thing?
Oh, absolutely. I love Minnesota Rose. And I'm assuming that you wrote all the lyrics that are in the book. Have you written music to it as well?
No.
Would you think about that? I mean, they sounded like great songs.
No, I guess some singer-songwriter is going to have to come along and dig this book enough to want to do that.
Put the music in it. Mm-hmm. Kirkus Review called the book, I'm quoting, "a great big shaggy dog story that gives the matter of getting stoned appropriate gravity while recognizing that sometimes, given reality and all those Republicans running around, it seems the better part of valor to check out on one's mind for a time." Do you think that's a fair reading?
Well, I don't exactly know what the appropriate gravity for getting stoned is. And, you know, everybody always dreads their Kirkus Review.
Oh, really?
It's the one that is usually a stinker. That one came from the publisher to me, celebrated. This is a great review from Kirkus, you know.
But what about the shaggy dog story? Did you intend the book to be a satire?
Hey, I really accept that because I think if I understand what a shaggy dog story is it just kind of goes around in circles until you finally come to this end. And I mean, my father used to, when I told him a joke that took too long, he'd say something like, "All that for this?" I mean, like, it just, the punchline wasn't big enough for all the story. And you know, I think it's a fair criticism because I don't know how to write a detective fiction, at least when I started this one. So, and I think there's something that when you approach a detective fiction at this, at least somebody like me who's been writing literary novels, it's kind of hard to take it 100% seriously. There's a noir tradition that's in everybody's brain and through so many noir films that I almost want to write an anti-detective novel or a detective novel in which the characters, the two detectives and the two most active detectives in this and an FBI agent are sitting around talking about poetry.
That's right.
I mean, how realistic that is, I don't know. Somebody asked me, like, what do you feel like the most subversive thing about this novel is? And my answer was that the most subversive thing is not the talking about politics, but getting 15 really good poems into the book by other people and getting people to read them without almost realizing they're reading poetry. Now, wow.
That's right. That was very slick.
It almost sounds like dialogue because they're speaking them as dialogue. Yeah. And yeah, so the shaggy dog thing is seems apt to me.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the poetry. And the title of the book, The Man in the Blizzard, is from a poem by Thomas McGrath. And is it the entire poem that's in the book or a piece of the poem in the book?
No, I have the entire poem.
It's a very short poem.
A very short poem. I should tell listeners that Sabatini is kind of an evangelical poetry freak who's trying through the course of the novel to get different people to memorize poems and is quite successful, even though most of them are resistant at first. And my main character, Augie, is from the beginning of the novel, he tells us about Sabatini, and he doesn't want to give Sabatini the pleasure of knowing that he's actually memorizing poems. And what he's really memorizing is a great poem by Thomas McGrath, which is called A Letter to an Imaginary Friend, which is more than 10,000 lines long. So he memorizes at the pace of 10 lines a day. And so in 1,000 days, with any luck, he's going to spring all 10,000 lines on Sabatini. But here, towards the end of the book, he's using this little poem, The Man in the Blizzard by Tom McGrath as well, to describe himself. He says, "I have a poem which pretty much describes my life as a pothead and detective, the man in the blizzard. Even his tracks are gone, and of course, his shadow. But he keeps walking around, searching, certain that someone, himself perhaps, was here before, or will be."
That's a great poem.
Yeah, it seemed like a great poem for a detective novel, and I used the first two lines of it as an epigraph. Even his tracks are gone, and of course, his shadow.
Another poet featured in your book is Mike Tuggle, the poet laureate of Sonoma County. I thought you must be at least acquainted with each other.
We met when I was 17 and took a still in high school and took a college class in writing poetry and met Mike, and we've been friends all these years. And this is a wonderful poem of his called Divorce. The ring finger aching for its ring months after it has been removed feels naked and scared. The thick gold band, which had become almost like another knuckle over the years, lies now in a box somewhere, circling nothing but air, dreaming of its finger.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
Wow, I really like that. That's Mike Tuggle's poem, Divorce. Mm-hmm. And I'm here in the studio with Bart Schneider, the author of The Man in the Blizzard, and we're talking about his recent book of the same name. The way you've set up the book, the people who memorize poetry are the good guys, of course, because they're the friends of Bobby Sabatini, the one who's crazy about poetry. And so the bad guys don't get to be on the poetry at all. I thought that was a nice literary stroke on your part.
I never thought about it that way, but you're right.
Yeah. Let's talk about Augie Boyer, your protagonist. He eats too much fried food. He smokes too much pot, and he's a little bit slow to figure things out. I thought he was a wonderful protagonist because he's so human, and he's a terrific dad to Minnesota Rose. His wife, Nina, has left him, run off with a therapist, and when Minnesota Rose sends him an email that she's going to be there for the big Labor Day thing, I really couldn't wait for Minnesota Rose to walk onto the stage because I could feel already she was going to be a terrific character.
In an early draft of this novel, it was called Minnesota Rose, and I decided to thin out her role a little bit. I was writing it with the sense of there being a tragedy in the end, and she was actually going to be shot, killed, assassinated, and then I kind of thought about that. I thought, you're not writing a book like that, you know? I mean, in previous books, I've sort of liked the idea that one of the things that I seem to be able to do well is break readers' hearts. But I didn't think I was writing this spoofy book, you know, so to have a murder at the end was, or an assassination seemed really forced to me, though I was writing it that way, you know, with that in mind for quite a while. So you might feel a little bit of the shadow she left because...
Well, perhaps that's it.
And it's interesting because in my second novel, Secret Love, I was writing from the point of view of both the husband and the wife, and about, you know, almost at the end of the first draft, I realized that the wife had already died, and I had to take her out. I mean, I was writing from her point of view, so that whole hunk of stuff came out. But it's one of those things, at least in my experience writing a novel, when you realize these things, you can't fake it anymore.
No,
I mean,
no.
It's like, it's, oh, yeah, she's already died.
Yeah.
And he's not cheating on her. He's not able to deal very well with his grief, which made him much more interesting to me.
Yes.
And then after I finished that novel, Secret Love, I realized, oh, but I want to write about her point of view. So I had to write a whole new novel, which...
Oh, so you wrote them in reverse order.
I wrote them
of the chronology.
Yeah, because I needed her to be alive.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So it's a prequel.
Mm-hmm. A prequel. Well, I'm certainly glad that you preserved Minnesota Rose because I'd like to see her make another appearance. And I try to be careful not to give away too much of the plot to people who haven't read the book yet. So, okay, folks, you know that Minnesota Rose survives the assassination attempts. And I like the way you had the book in short bits. I mean, some of your chapters were only a couple of pages long, and then, of course, others were a little longer than that. But that really worked for me. It made it picked up the pace.
Yeah, I've always worked with relatively short chapters, and I think I did that from my first novel on because it was a way of kind of enabling myself to, I thought, yeah, if you can get through, like, try to get into doing one of these a day, it's a doable amount of, the terrifying thing about sitting down to write a novel is there's so much to do, but if you see it as this very small bit you need to do each day, it's much more, something you can do with building blocks. And
step at a time.
Slow and steady.
Yeah. Before we go on to the other novels, I'd like you to read something from The Man in the Blizzard, Bobby Sabatini, talking about poetry, and I think it starts on page 46.
What this town needs is a poetry bar. I'm not talking about that spoken word. Nah, that's joined to the hip to hip-hop. What I'm talking about is a bar that has a karaoke machine with nothing but good poems on it. You could just use an overhead projector, Bobby. Sabatini shook his head. Nah, I want something flashier than that. I want beautifully letter-pressed broadsides projected onto the screen. I want atmospheric music in the background of each poem. I want a place where a guy would feel safe and cozy reading Theodore Rethke poems through the speakers. I liked listening to Sabatini rap and saw it as a public service. After all, I was one of the few people he could let his hair down with, strutting around as a poetry proselytizing police detective is a delicate proposition. Sabatini stood up and started pacing. Can't you see some large-lunged dude coming in to rap a sheaf of Whitman on one of Pound's Pison Cantos? And the women channeling Sylvia Plath, Jane Kenyon, Mary Oliver. Think of the night when a table full of beautiful incest survivors do Sharon Olds. That's what poetry can lead to, transformation. That's right, I said. They come in sipping Sauvignon Blanc and they go out quaffing dirty martinis. Now, Augie, don't you see? The potential is unlimited. Sabatini threw his arms into the air in glee. Guys would come down for bachelor parties to perform W.S. Merwin's The Vixen. Sabatini's eyes misted up as he told me about a sergeant down at Rice Street whom he had memorizing Auden, but his joy was short-lived. He leaned against the wall, closed his eyes, and looked troubled. What's the matter, Bobby? I don't know, Augie. Sometimes I wonder why Americans are as afraid of poetry as they are of Al-Qaeda. Screw the ones who've decided that poetry is an effete enterprise. Let them party with the homophobes. It's the others who concern me. The folks who claim they don't get it, who think they're too dumb to read poetry. Thing is, they're not willing to be dumb enough. That's their problem. If you want to get inside a poem, you need to dumb down to your senses. That's where the receptors are. You need to accept that you don't know. Why should you know? What's the matter with a little mystery? They think the poem's a theorem. If they can't solve it, if they can't control it, then they're afraid of it. It's so American to want it all or nothing. If you can't conquer it, what good is it? Americans have become so frozen with fear they've lost their sense of play. It's time to lighten up and lower our expectations. It's time to rediscover our basic fluency. If a man's not fluent, if he ain't got the flow, what chance does he have to converse with his soul? Consider Jim Moore, the king of fluency, the master of St. Paul in his poem, Invisible Strings. I vow to write 7 poems today. Look down and see a crow rising into thick rain on 5th Avenue, as if pulled up by invisible strings, and already there are only 6 to go. That, my friend, is fluency. Question, Bobby, I said. Having truly cultivated the dumb part of my brain and become a master of lowering my expectations, shouldn't I have a special aptitude for poetry? Absolutely, Augie, although it might be a while until you're dumb enough for Auden. Ah, but Sergeant Bernansky, he slayed me the other day with the elegy for Yeats. He's working on the Freud elegy now. After that, who knows? Maybe the bucolics. The question is, where do I send him after he's nailed a bit more Auden? It seemed to be a troubling consideration for Sabatini, but suddenly his eyes shot bright. He grinned at me and whispered, Milos. Sabatini loved Milos. He loved pronouncing the man's name. It was really a treat to hear him say the full name. Bobby immersed himself in the project just like a method actor, and by the time he'd finished saying, Chislo Milos, he all but hailed from Krakow. With Milos, Sabatini said, you tease them along at first with one of the two-line gems. I'm particularly partial to his poem, Learning. To believe you are magnificent and gradually to discover that you are not magnificent. Enough labor for one human life. Yeah, so Bobby, tell me the truth here. Are you still in the magnificent stage? Sabatini nodded. Yeah, but I'm beginning to sense the shift. Meanwhile, let me tell you about my new convert. I've been working with an FBI agent named Francis Singh. You've got the FBI memorizing poems? Oh, Augie, this guy is a quick steady. I mean, in a matter of weeks, he shot through the Black Mountain poets. Olson, Creeley, Levertov, Ed Dorn. Before I know it, he's asking questions about Olson's essay, Projective Verse, that I can't begin to answer. Sounds like he's ready for some Lorca, I said, talking out of my hat. But I got away with it. Yeah, the gypsy ballads are a thought.
Oh, that's wonderful, and I like all the pieces of poetry that you included. Bobby Sabatini is a wonderful character, isn't he?
I've had a very interesting experience with the character of Bobby Sabatini in that I've never had this experience with a character, but he's really influenced me in with all that poetry stuff. I've started writing poetry again, not memorizing it, mind you, but writing it, and I came up as a poet, and so there's this kind of dual influence in having written this book with so much poetry in it and coming back to my native place, more or less, that I've just been flooded with poems coming at me. I can't keep them away. They just, I don't know, writing fiction can be dangerous.
What a wonderful experience to have poems moving in on you.
Yeah, they just have been coming right and left. Everything sort of announces itself, and I realize, here's another poem.
Here comes another one. Wow, we should all have this problem. When I read that the first time, it reminded me of a poem. So I want to read a poem to you, if I may. Billy Collins' Introduction to Poetry. I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin by beating it with a hose to find out what it really means.
I think it's interesting how much poetry is taught, or people have the misconception that it's something that we've got to get.
Yes.
In a way that we don't think about classical music or abstract painting. I mean, I'm not sitting down listening to Shostakovich trying to figure out exactly what it means, you know.
Classical music, it's a perfect segue into where we're going next. First, we'll take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and my guest in the studio is Bart Schneider. We'll be right back.
Tactful cactus by your window, surveys the prairie of your room. Mobile spins to its collision. Clara puts a head between the boards. Vauban shops down on the west side. Find a home, but the key to the city is in the sun that bends the branches to the sky. Oh, oh.
Listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest in the studio is Bart Schneider, and we've been discussing his book, The Man in the Blizzard. Did you have fun matching up the poets and the characters?
You know, I didn't really think in terms of matching up the poets and characters as much as finding a poem that seemed right for the particular occasion in the book. And because there's a lot of patter going on, and, you know, so I was reading a lot of stuff because obviously I had to find fairly short poems, and there were a lot of poets who I loved that I wanted to include, but I couldn't find the right stuff by them. And so it became serendipitous to find what seemed right.
Mm. Well, let's go to the San Francisco novel set in San Francisco in the 1960s, Beautiful Inez and Secret Love. Beautiful Inez is a concert violinist, and you certainly have a wide and deep knowledge of the world of classical music.
Well, I grew up in a house my dad played violin in the San Francisco Symphony, so I had that close by all the time, and I heard a lot of stories. He was a very good storyteller, and I was always intrigued by his descriptions of other musicians who seemed to be many of them more angst-ridden than he was. He was somebody who had the temperament to be a section violinist. A lot of people who came into the symphony were trained to be virtuosos, and especially in his time, a lot of people fleeing Europe who had really been very prominent musicians found themselves in the middle of a section, and the conductors were like dictators, and there was a lot of cynicism, a lot of darkness. And he also got me interested in the curiosity of virtuosos, which I kind of included Inez as one of those, somebody who trained so well, so much, you know, from early childhood, that at least in my interpretation, there's something emotionally that didn't develop. And I've always found that curious, that the idea of, and maybe not healthy, the idea of our training gymnasts for 6 or 8 hours a day or whatever, and ballerinas. I mean, it just doesn't seem like binding somebody's feet almost. And so I'm thinking of somebody who is practicing on this spot for 8 hours a day, and what happens to the rest of their life? And So having my father as a resource was wonderful. And he died the year that this came out, but he did get to read it in proofs. And I did some fun things with him, like talking through the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, which I had the score of. I'd borrowed from him, and I was back in Minnesota. And I'd say, okay, walk me through this part. You know, tell me, like, what – just because I never played the violin, so I have no idea what – the physical difficulties were, and so he could tell me about a couple spots and I could fake it from there, you know. But it was fun to do that with him fun for him as well to have me paying that much attention to something that was, you know, second nature to him. I actually had the manuscript of the Mendelssohn that he had from when he was a boy. So it had the markings that his teacher made on them in the 20s.
He played the Mendelssohn as a boy.
I think, you know, 10 years old or something, you know.
Amazing. But your wonderful creation of Inez, the violinist who is trained as a virtuoso, but prefers to play in the orchestra as a member of the orchestra. And I felt the point at which she finally performs as a soloist was a turning point in the book.
I don't know how much of a turning point it was. For Inez, I mean, what my struggle was with that novel is trying to get inside the head of somebody who is very suicidal, and to try to understand how they value their own achievements. And I mean, the first question I had to answer was, how could somebody actually think about killing themselves if they had two children? How could a mother do that? And the answer I came up with was that she determined that they would be better off without her. And mm-hmm. So that was a tough book to write because I knew what was going to happen, and I knew I had to go straight through, and I wanted to be as emotionally true to it as I could. And I think my sense was that and I talked to a lot of people who had experience with suicides or knew people who were suicidal, and a lot of people gave me the sense that there's a sort of engine that's driving people who have that condition that is almost unstoppable. It's like a train, and so. The thing I thought I could throw into the middle of this was a love affair for her that would at least put that drive into a pause that would give it its best chance to reverse fate.
And that drive that you describe is exactly the way that I as a reader experienced it. And I knew that she would not be diverted from suicide, but it was almost like going through the mental process with her. And by the end of the book, I felt I had an understanding of the suffering that she was going through, which the end was inevitable, that she would kill herself. But it's so beautifully done.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I really think it's an irrational drive that you can line up on a sheet of paper all the things this woman has going for her, and that one self-destructive impulse crushes it all.
That's right. It's beyond reason. It has nothing to do with reason.
It
comes from somewhere else, right? Because she certainly had everything to live for. I wanted to ask you, too, you have very good working knowledge of the symphony orchestra. Did you go to rehearsals with your father when you were young?
Not often. No, I listened to him talk a lot, and mm-hmm. and he also wrote a book. I gave him a blank book on his 60th birthday, and I said, you know, you're such a good storyteller. You should write your story. And he went ahead and did that, and it also became the history of the San Francisco Symphony. It came out in 1983, and, you know, was a local bestseller for, and he'd come out at intermission in his full dress and sell copies, I mean, signed copies at Davies or wherever they were then, and it was a really good book. So I learned from that as well, where he had just tons of personal stories, but also the stories of the symphony.
What did he call his book?
Music, Maestros, and Musicians, The History of the San Francisco Symphony. And his name's David Schneider.
Is it in print?
I don't think it is anymore, but, you know.
People can find it.
People can find it, because it's if you go to abebooks.com
or
something
like
that.
Right, they have everything.
Right, but one thing that amused me is this is the only book he wrote, but he dedicated it in part to me and said to my son, Bart, also a writer.
Let me tell you one of the clues that I had about you knowing how the orchestra works from the inside. When Inez is playing the solo part of the concerto, she realizes that the conductor, who is pretty inept, and I'm sure he's not based on a real person, loses his place, and she guides him back onto the correct page in the score just through signals that he would pick up. The intimacy that you brought to the symphony orchestra simply by being there with Inez in the symphony, I think was wonderful for readers. You know, you sit there and watch the orchestra, and sometimes you wonder, you know, what's going on? What's the politics here? What's in their heads? And all that sort of thing. And when you read beautiful Inez, you're there.
So tell me what you thought about the lesbian sex.
I thought
that when you were talking intimacy, I thought that's what you were going to mention.
I thought that's where I was going. That was a really effective way of restoring Inez to her physical self, because she had gone to live somewhere else in her head, and she obviously was not enjoying sex with her husband. And we've got to talk about Jake, her husband. What a wonderful character. And then Sylvia, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Appears out of the blue, and they develop a passionate affair, and Inez discovers pleasure. And one would think that that might save her from her suicidal attempt, but no, it drives it. It drives it, I think. No, I thought you handled that part of it remarkably well. Sylvia is a wonderful character. But a triangle between the husband, the wife, and another woman, I think would be fairly difficult to write, was it?
I felt like I needed to actually write sex scenes between these two women to earn that intimacy. I couldn't just kind of write around it. And somebody, a sales rep before this book came out from Random House, came up to me, and a man, and said, "Man, how did you get that lesbian sex just right?" And I said, "How do you know that I did? You know, I don't know that I did, but you know, that is a case of intimacy. That, you know, I think sex is kind of about intimacy between people
and pleasure."
Pleasure that man woman yeah. woman, you know, so it's not that hard to imagine, you know, and the way I seem to get into writing about sensuality, sexuality, pleasure in general is through writing about music and food, and landscape, but particularly music and food, because they deliver it for me, you know. So I have these women eating goat cheese and boucheron. And
that's right. The specifics of it are so important.
Right, and having Ravel playing, a Ravel quartet playing just at the time that one is seducing the other is...
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I find the specificity of it is always works with me. You know, if I know which restaurant they're eating in and what they're having and what it's like. And that creates the scene so that one just enters right in. I mean, the reader is there with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There is a lot of food. And restaurants and landmarks. Yes. I mean, you really create the San Francisco of the 60s.
Well, I was there then. I was a boy. So in Beautiful Inez is set when I was 11 years old, and Secret Love 2 years later. And I was aware of a lot that was going on, but I kind of felt like I was on tiptoe, you know, watching things. You know, I was very much like Sylvia, who calls herself a watcher, a voyant.
A voyant, yes.
Mm-hmm. She likes the French version, voyant, you know, part clairvoyant.
Yeah.
As well as voyeur, you know.
Right. I'd like to read the first two paragraphs of Beautiful Inez because they are about that same thing. Language, as Sylvia's mother was fond of saying, mimics the human condition. What is harmless one moment can become fatal the next. Drop a prefix, and before you know it, what was innocuous has grown noxious, dispensing fumes that are certain to kill you. Take voyeur, which derives from the French voir, to see. A powerless or passive spectator, you might define it in that way, if you were willing to strip away its unsavory meanings and free it from the clutches of peeping toms. I mean, language is very important to you.
You know, I'm a failed musician, and I think my father's mastery left me with some kind of mental block about creating my own music, and so what I have left is language, which I treat, I think, in a pretty musical way. And
you do. It's lyrical.
I don't write everything out loud, but I have a kind of out loud inside my head, so I'm really hearing the language. And having come up as a poet, I'm particularly sensitive to language. Mm-hmm. And that's all I got to work with, you know. And it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sound, but also the meaning and the plenties of meanings that you can come up with language. And, you know, I have a character in the book before Secret Love,
yes,
who's a African American,
yes,
a gay African American, mm-hmm, man who talk about trying to create a character,
yes,
that is going against the grain, a gay African American man who suddenly realizes he wants to become a black Muslim, where,
yeah,
homosexuality is not exactly celebrated.
He's such an appealing character.
But his nickname, as I was writing him, you know, I thought, God, his vocabulary is a little bit more like mine, or more imaginative than a normal, he's the son of a reverend in a big church, than most black kids on the street, at least that I knew growing up. So his nickname becomes Dictionary, which as soon as I thought, okay, they're calling him Dictionary, then I can get away with having him have a heightened language.
Let's talk a bit about Jake Roseman, who's married to Beautiful Inez, and is in both the books, of course. Is Jake based on a real person?
No, but there was a real person that was a bit of a physical inspiration to me. I had a elementary school friend whose father was the president of the San Francisco Painters Union and was later assassinated in San Francisco, and I'd love to find out how that all resolved, because I was about 10 or 11 when that happened. But he was a civil rights leader, and I remember this girl calling me up and inviting me to come to a protest at like a car dealership when I was about 11 years old. And I mean, I knew what it was about, but I, you know, it was a little advanced for me at age 11. But I saw her father one time at a parent-teacher conference, and he was this totally charismatic guy with a big fat mustache wearing Bermuda shorts. And so I stole those two attributes, the mustache and the Bermuda shorts, thinking, what kind of a absurd creature wears Bermuda shorts around San Francisco, where I never owned a pair of shorts until I moved to Minnesota because it was always too cold. Mm-hmm. So I started out with that, those two attributes. And I knew an attorney who was a Sunday school teacher of mine in San Francisco named Franklin Brann, who himself became a suicide, but he was a very moving man that had once been active in local San Francisco politics. So I took a little bit of his personality and kind of blended him into Jake. But those are just little shadows that you take and try to make a character. And one of the advantages, I think, or I don't know if it's an advantage, but one of the ways I have of working into a character is through dialogue, because I started, before I wrote novels, I wrote plays, and it's all dialogue. So I think I have a fairly easy time feeling the way people talk, their rhythms, and it's, again, an ear thing. And once you get the way somebody talks, you're feeling it in your body. You're feeling the way they move a little bit and just the way they carry themselves. And I had him talking, and I had his big mustache, and I had his Bermuda shorts. That was enough.
And then his father, Isaac, particularly in Secret Love, when Isaac has suffered a stroke and is such a difficult old man. I mean, it's such a complicated relationship between Jake and his father. And you wrote it with such feeling, and there was tenderness written into the tension between them.
Though Jake had fantasies of smothering his father
to death.
That's
right, and his father figured that out. Right? But, you know, not enough is written about that sort of thing that can come on a person late in life to deal with a very difficult parent, and how it affected Jake's life and how difficult it was for Isaac.
Yeah. I noticed with my own mother, which happened after I wrote that book, that, you know, the way dementia can kind of come upon people late in their life when all their abilities have been stripped away from them. And mm-hmm. in my mother's case, she started feeling like people were stealing from her.
Yes.
Because something else was mm-hmm. being stolen from her. And that yeah. is a fairly common yeah. Experience mm-hmm. of people with dementia.
Yeah. And you write a beautiful love story, and you write terrific sex scenes. But in addition to that, you can deal with the difficult relationship between the generations. And we haven't even talked about the children who were left motherless after the suicide of beautiful Inez. I wish we had more time to, and I'd love to spend another half an hour talking about the San Francisco books. Let me tell our readers again about the books. I've been talking with Bart Schneider, and first of all, we talked about his most recent novel, The Man in the Blizzard, and then we talked about the two linked books, which are set in San Francisco in the 60s, Beautiful Inez and Secret Love. They're available in bookstores and at the public library, and I can promise you, you will enjoy these books very, very much. Thank you so much, Bart, for taking the time to come in and talk about your work.
Hey, thank you, Rosemary, for paying such close attention to it.
Well, they deserve close attention. They're beautifully done. And thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. And we'll be back next month with another San Francisco story. And in the meantime, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and A Novel Idea will be back next month, Wednesday, December 10th. Rosemary will be in conversation with Lizanne Bassam, whose book One of Another has just been published. They'll be talking about AIDS in literature. And I'll be back next month, too. I had such a good time talking with you all last month on KRCB's Book Club of the Air. that I want to do it again. I invite you to join in a conversation with me and some others in the studio and talk about best books of this past year. What did you love? Were there some literary surprises out there? What challenged your thinking or just made you laugh? Share with me and your fellow listeners your recommendations and reactions to what you've read. Join KRCB's Book Club of the Air and me, Suzanne Lang, on Thursday, December 4th at 7, right here on KRCB, where we are connecting our communities and telling our stories.
You are a genie, and all I ask for is your smile each time I rub the lamp. La 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 la. When I am with you, I have a giggling teenage crush, and now a sultry man.
Before I say goodnight to you this evening, I want to let you know of some upcoming events that may be of interest to you. At Montgomery Village Copperfields, tomorrow evening at 7, that's November 20th at 7, author John Tarrant will be there with his book, Bring Me the Rhinoceros and Other Zen Koans That Will Save Your Life. John is a local author and spiritual teacher who shows us that finding happiness is as simple as subverting unhappiness. With paradoxical questions geared to challenge your beliefs and tip you a little off kilter, Bring Me the Rhinoceros and Other Zen Koans That Will Save Your Life. That's John Tarrant's new book. And on Friday, November 21st at 7 at Book Passage in Corte Madera, Camille Cusimano will be there with her new book, Tango, An Argentine Love Story. Camille needed to heal the wounds of a long-term failed relationship, so took off for Buenos Aires, where she met her true passion, tango, and decided to stay there indefinitely. Go listen to her talk about her tale and her new book, Tango, An Argentine Love Story. That's Camille Cusimano at Book Passage, Friday at 7. And then on Sunday, November 30th, at Copperfields Montgomery Village in Santa Rosa, Barry Kitterman will be there with his debut novel, The Baker's Boy, the story of a middle-aged man whose history haunts him as he approaches fatherhood. That's Sunday, November 30th, at Copperfields. And noted Southern writer Sherry Reynolds will appear at Reader's Books in Sonoma with her new book, The Sweet In Between, and that is Monday evening, December 8th at 7. That's at Reader's Books in Sonoma. I hope you'll tune in every Wednesday at 7 right here to KRCB for literary and cultural programming. I'm Suzanne Lang, wishing you good night, and as Rosemary Manchester loves to say, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
You're the poetry man. You make things all right.